Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation. Trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you, committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with confidence unleashed.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. Smart Travel doesn't just cover points and miles. They break down all the financial aspects of your trip, whether that's the best days to book, how to avoid hidden fees, or which fancy travel credit cards pay off, and which ones are just an expensive flex. If you want your travel budget to work harder, then dive into the best deals, products, services, and more with Smart Travel from NerdWallet, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Dara here. Oh, I am happy today. Okay, here's that. I'm still flying on everybody that came out to see me on Thursday night. I didn't write down all the names, but I am just so happy. Thank you for everyone that came to the big book launch for Pilar. Her Healthy Deviant book is getting a nice send-off. It was a nice sold-out crowd. You can go see her on the 16th at Majors & Quinn. You want your own signed copy. It's just a lifetime of wisdom is just pounded into that book as a war and peace of how to live. It's just so good. And I really appreciate all y'all who came out. It was a WCCO house. I love y'all. Okay, so here's what I've got for you today. Who's in the mood for a surf and turf? I hope it's you. That's what the next hour is going to be. Yeah, I got the big guns. I got Randy Stanley in the house, founder of Six Smith and Baldemar, longtime GM of Manny's. If you have eaten an expense account steak in the last two decades in the Twin Cities, Randy Stanley has been somewhere in the mix. I do love a good steakhouse. And Baldemar, I have been told not to just keep saying it's the best thing in the suburbs, because that's apparently not a thing you're supposed to say, but it is in fact in Roseville and it's quite good. And later on in the hour, Josh Nelson of Almanac Fish and Fish Guys, little St. Paul in the house. He knows everything that there is to know about the current state of sustainable seafood. I'm very interested in this. Long-time listeners of the show know that I have been trying to figure out fish farms good, fish farms bad for like a decade now. And so I'm going to bother Josh about that, see if we can get to the bottom of it. So it's just a good show. Do you want to text? Do you want to call in? I've got the number 651-989-9226. You got any surf and turf questions? We will pepper them. We will throw them at Randy Stanley. Randy, welcome to the show. So Randy, as I said, founder of Six Smith and Baldemar. Baldemar, brand new, making big waves. We do not say that it's the best steakhouse in the suburbs because we've been embargoed. We're told not to say that, but can't stop myself. Longtime GM of Manny's. Randy, welcome.
Thanks, Dara. It's good to be here.
I think the last time we had you on the show, you were talking about your Thanksgiving traditions, and you always make a little space for the kind of orphans so they can come into the restaurants, right?
That's very true.
Very nice of you. All right, so tell me about, let's just go straight into Baldemar. A lot of people have gone to the suburbs to open important restaurants, and a lot of people have failed, but you decided you're not afraid.
Not afraid of the first-tier suburbs in particular. there's a lot of things happening downtown, which pushes people a little more to the first-tier suburbs, not just the restaurant business, but retailers as well.
So downtown is in chaos. Downtown Minneapolis, like the central skyscraper district, Oh, we all know it's happening. I mean,
you were a little more aggressive than I was.
Well, things only close. You know, we had this lovely golden age where we had Solera and some other stuff. And now it's just, unless you're on Nicollet Mall, Nicollet Mall seems to be like the, you know, refuge where people like to go. But everything else is kind of either, it's just Bar District now.
It's a sad state of affairs, I think, downtown right now. And they seem to lack direction and vision, and it's made it hard for independent business people to venture into downtown and try to make a go of things.
Yeah, the rents are sky high. I was talking to somebody who has a, you know, kind of a social justice mindset the other day, and I was talking about how many restaurants aren't in downtown anymore. She's like, "Oh, gentrification." I was like, "That's not it at all. This is the opposite. Like, it's some kind of an opposite situation." I mean, because a lot of when I talk to people, what I'm hearing is that a lot of coastal money has flooded in. They buy the properties. They have an idea of the rents that should be charged, and those rents are way out of line for what anybody here can make back. And therefore, things just sit empty.
It's prohibitive for small business people like myself and most of the people that I know and work with.
Yeah, there's a reason why the core businesses that are making it are in small, non-skyscraper buildings. So I will say, there are some great places. Dakota, everybody should support Dakota. It is a local jewel. The food is still fantastic. You might spend some time at some point in your week. Check out the Dakota Cooks calendar and see the jazz greats that come through. It's a jewel. I don't talk about the Dakota enough, and that's totally off topic because we're talking about Baltimore. But you decided first-tier suburb. So you, the Six Smith was your first independent restaurant, right?
That's correct.
And it was a bit of a rocky launch. Like, it was hard to figure out what the people really want and would really come for.
Rocky is an understatement. I opened up I try to find places that I think are emerging, and that was probably the beginning of the first-tier suburb trend. I mean, people really are trying to I think people really inherently like to be in an urban environment, but downtown's just a little sketchy right now, so they're gravitating or migrating towards those first-tier suburbs. And I was an early pioneer. I did some work studying that demographic in that area, and there were, unfortunately, five people before me who didn't make it in that location. And so I had to.
So it's right on the, if anybody doesn't know, it's in Wayzata, right on the lake. I like the idea of you being a pioneer. Like, nobody's ever been to, nobody ever come to Wayzata to open a restaurant before. But I think what it looked like from where I sat is that you found out that the people of Wayzata want everything. They want free parking. They want a boat menu. They want cheap happy hour. And then they want elite cooking. They want it all.
Well, it's the cool thing is Six Smith really appeals to a different demographic. We did some demographic work and realized that it's a 5-mile, 10-minute drive time. And within that 5 miles, there's about 150, 60,000 30 to 50-year-olds with an average income, household income over 100,000. And that, to me, is the sweet spot because that's the young, aspirational adult who grew up watching the Food Channel, traveling the world, looking for authenticity, unique concepts. You can't fool them. They've been there, done that. And the old days of big portions and mediocre food flavor profiles are coming to an end. So we had to come up with a concept that would appeal to that demographic and pull people into the market, rather, because Wayzata is only like 4,700 people. So to make it all year long, and it's a big, big, big space.
Year long, that's the key.
Exactly.
You got to get people January through March.
You are correct.
You don't get that 25% of the year. You can't make it.
You can't. The magic was becoming relevant in the winter. And we figured out how to do it. It took a lot of work. There was a lot of sleepless nights.
If you're comfortable talking about it.
For sure.
Because I remember your menu started kind of more chefy ambitious. And then you kind of – it wasn't like you stopped that, but you dialed down parts of it and brought in other elements. That's what it looked like to me.
You're spot on. The other thing was we had to figure out our plating. I mean, Six Smith was probably the most – concepted non-concept I've ever worked on. And it took a while to articulate it in a way that people understood it, you know, both in terms of food, atmosphere, and the service kind of came together right away. But it did take us a while to dial in on the food and get the recipes right and the plating right so that it was
I don't think I understand your distinction on the plating. How does the plating affect?
Like the materials that we use. So this is 5.5 years ago, and we were trying to find things like Heath China, which is from Sausalito hand-thrown stoneware, and you couldn't find any of this stuff, and cast iron and wood platters and things like that. And there was a bunch of people, not just, like myself, that were trying to find these things, but you could go to a food show in Chicago, go online and look on calendars, and you couldn't find any of that stuff.
And does that make a difference?
Oh, it was hard.
In the bottom line of the restaurant? I mean, I know it makes a big difference if you're buying a bunch of plates and they all break.
Well, yeah. And the sad thing, Dara, is when you break one of our plates, it's $40.
Yeah. But you felt like I'm so surprised to hear you feel that the plating was part of the actual,
Oh, absolutely.
Tableware.
No question. Big decisions, I think. And the same thing happens at Baltimore. But the difference for
is
me.
Is it in Does it impact people's perception of value?
Big time. It separates you from the pack, because most restaurateurs, especially larger format big companies, won't spend the money on the china and plating that we do.
So is that how you get across that you're different from an Applebee's? It's
one
the actual
of the
stuff on the
yeah.
on the yeah. table that I
Their investors and board of directors would freak out every day if they had to live with the decisions that I make.
Good. They should.
Yeah.
Afflict the comfortable. All right.
We live a comfortable life, but, I have the liberty of balancing my financial needs with what the customer is looking for and the employees. So.
Okay, so I am really shocked to hear that you felt like this, 5.5 years ago, that the actual plates, the tableware, the things that you see when you're sitting down there, that was part of what you needed to dial in better
than the.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And so when you opened Baltimore, which you just did you kind of, use that experience?
Absolutely. The good news is the different kinds of plateware, glassware, et cetera, because of the influence of the microbreweries, the cocktail movement, and then the chefiness of the expectations in every restaurant now, that whole opportunity to purchase china and glassware that are novel and cool and hip has exploded. So it's a lot easier to find it. And then I couple that with when we were putting things together for Baltimore, we had a platform to work with at Sixsmith. So we were able to nail it right away instead of having.
So I feel like part of what you've succeeded at is that mix of price points. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. It's a mix of experiences, if you will. So on any given day, you can come in, like you said, have happy hour, sit at the bar, spend, $18-22 and with some of your friends. The next night you come in and sit in the bar dining room and you have a burger and a sandwich and you're spending $25-28. And then the next night the president of CCO comes in and says, "Hey, Dara, good job. We're giving you a big promotion. You own the place. Let's party
Shannon,
down."
Shannon, are you listening? All right. That's interesting. We should take a little break here, but I want to talk about this. I have a lot of theories about the Minnesota customer who doesn't like, except for Manny's, there's a one exception for Manny's, but doesn't like to go somewhere where they know they're going to have to spend a lot. Like, they will spend a lot, but you get a better chance of getting that person if there's like an $8 option, a $12 option on the menu. They like to have that. Oh, he's giving me the you're right on. All right, we'll talk about this, the psychology of the Minnesota diner when we come back. Dara here. We're back. I'm talking to Randy Stanley. He's the founder of Sixsmith Baltimore Restaurants in the Twin Cities Metro, and he was a longtime GM of Manny's, the steakhouse that breaks all the rules, because okay, this is what we're doing. I'm fully just analyzing the psychology of the Minnesota diner. So if this is you, Minnesota diner, pull up a chair, because I'm going to tell you who you are. Okay, so Minnesota diners, I truly believe this, are really smart at just basic back-of-the-envelope math. They have more money than people think they do, and they don't like to spend it, or they don't like to be obligated to spend it against their will. This is different. Like, I think in other markets, people love flashing their cash. It's very socially prestigious. You're in Los Angeles, knowing that you're going to the expensive place. You're in New York City, telling people you're going to the place where they know you're dropping a lot of money. That has social currency. Minnesota, not like that. Minnesotans like to go to a restaurant that has a $9 entree and then buy the $40 entree. But if the place doesn't have the $9 entree, they're not going. Like, that's my belief. And that is, I think, the secret to Bar La Grassa, the Isaac Becker restaurant, where it's got just a couple really cheap pastas. And people do get them, but then they maybe get, you know, $50 of other stuff. So now, that's my theory. That's who I think you are, Minnesota. You will not go in a space where you think you're going to be fleeced. You just won't even enter the door. Randy Stanley, what do you see? You've been in the actual game. I'm just observing from the sidelines. Is that true?
Spot on, Dara.
Yeah.
You are spot on. We're a cautious group. And like you said, the money's there. But first, someone has to prove themselves worthy, if you will. We're not into the blingy things. We do like attention, but it's not the overt type. It's more of a subtle sophistication.
And yet, there's the one restaurant that you were intimately involved with for a long time that breaks all that rules, and that's Manny's. For whatever reason, there's like everything, and then Manny's gets its own set of rules.
The bottom line at Manny's is they are super geniuses at making Joe Sixpack feel like Bob the Millionaire.
Yeah.
And
for 96 bucks a plate.
Cheap to go there. But it's magic. It really
it is.
It's magic. And they do get away with without having that $9 lead-in entree, but it took years, you know, for them to
I
remember
doing
the first days of Manny's, a $20,000 a week was a big deal, you know.
Oh, is that true?
Yes, the first couple of months, we were doing like $23,000-$24,000 a week, and you know, Phil Roberts, my mentor, was freaking out.
Oh, see, that's before my time. That's good for me to hear. All right, I got a comment on the text line. Free and plentiful parking is the biggest draw for any place, anywhere. 4 exclamation points! I have to agree with that. It's Minnesotans love free parking, and I think that restaurateurs, this has been the death of Uptown. I am just certain of it. The day that they stopped validating parking in Uptown was a day that everything started to fall apart. And I think it is because you very often go to a restaurant and you meet six people, or you meet three households. And so you're not parking your car once. That's three parking. Then at the point that it's 11 bucks to park, 33 bucks starts to be real money, and people don't want to spend it. They don't want to obligate their friend into paying 11 bucks to park. Like, so that's what I think is going on. I think that the day that they made Calhoun parking ramp validated again, everything would have sprung back to life, but it's never going to happen because the people that own it don't believe in it.
Money. One thing that I've learned at both restaurants, Baltimore and Sixsmith, is you can have valet and it could be even complimentary. But if people can see a parking space two blocks away, they will park there and walk as long as they can see your front door. And it probably has to do with, back as the city started to develop and then the suburbs and whatnot, the property wasn't as expensive. And so you could have these massive outdoor surface parking lots. And we just got used to it. And now it's just part of our culture, parking far away, but being able to see where you're going and feeling comfortable with that. You take a suburban person and put them in a parking ramp, and they're a lot of times confused if they're not used to driving downtown.
Parking ramps are confusing.
<That's>
There's so many. Like, we're such a land of experimental 1970s and 80s parking ramps. You're like, really? Yeah. That many pillars? Did you need that many pillars to make this thing stand up?
And then the Skyway. Navigating the Skyway.
That is a bunch. Yeah. But it's, it's not like I can fault anybody. It's you can spend put your $9 in your bank account or whatever. That's a better use of your money.
That's a good beer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So who wouldn't do that? All right. So that's it on the text line. Anybody else has got text observations? 651-989-9226. All right. So Randy Stanley, Baltimore, let's talk about it. You took the lessons of Sixsmith and you brought them to Baltimore. And so let's go through a few of the things. What is, like, if I haven't been, What are the things I need to get at Baltimore? What are the super delicious things? Let's get the inside scoop.
Well, at happy hour, we have like chicken and waffles, tuna poke. Those are some – you can get as adventuresome as you like and not as as adventuresome as you like. We have all of our center cut and steakhouse steaks are prime. So you can't go wrong with that. We're like the only ones in the Twin Cities, I believe, that serve 100% prime short line cuts.
Really? So yes. Prime is sort of I get marketed to probably more than anybody. So at one point,
I bet.
Okay, so prime is there are different grades of meat from the USDA, and prime indicates a certain degree of marbling. It's the best. It's the top. And then people will be like, ah, no, prime's not worth it. But is it?
It is. I mean, you could take five people. Put them at a table and bring out some choice, some prime. But it's also how it's aged and handled and cooked. And most people would not be able to choose the prime. I mean, I've done these kinds of tastings and half get it and half don't. But if you have your proprietary ways of cooking and seasoning, that's when things start separating. So it may be more interesting to take a steak from Baltimore or Pittsburgh Blue and Manny's Capital Grill, for example, and taste those side by side, that could be interesting.
My $1,000 interesting.
Yeah.
That could be.
I'm in on the challenge.
you've decided all in on prime.
Yes. We're all in on prime. It's the most expensive beef. It's less than 2% of all beef produced. And it gets expensive. I mean, it's mercurial pricing. And it's so volatile that most restaurateurs won't. Go that direction. But again, being independent, I don't have to explain to a group of investors why food cost is 50% this month.
I don't like the deregulation of the slaughterhouse system. People know I'm wildly against that. And I would prefer to eat from the more regulated, more observed, more intentional,
Absolutely.
More careful part of the food chain mm-hmm. because I don't trust, honestly, the self-regulation of the of the lesser parts of it. You decided to do kind of greatest hits, what people want to eat now, and then prime steaks and
yes.
and happy hour pricing, and that's the Baltimore strategy?
Well, the strategy is you could spend as little or as much as you like and get an experience. So at one table, you got somebody eating a filet and a Caesar salad and asparagus. And then sitting them right next to them is somebody like you that has three or four small plates and appetizers and sharing an entree with two other people. And so you can get this multitude of experiences. And we find that today's diner wants more adventure and experiences while they're dining, not just be married to your 20-ounce New York for $70 and a piece of parsley.
Is that because people go out more? I feel like people used to go out less and now they go out more. I see statistics
no
that say that people are going out, you know, half of their meals at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another motivation for keeping it flexible pricing so that you're not having to spend $100 every time you go out. It could be $30 one time, $22 another time. And that's one of the things that Baltimore and Sixsmith both do very, very well is creating a multitude of different price dining experiences.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, Randy Stanley, this has been delightful. I could talk to you forever.
Let's unpack.
Maybe we will. I'll just come on by. We'll just sit at the – get a microphone and we'll sit at the bar at Baltimore. That would actually be super fun.
You should do that.
We should do that.
Bring your kids.
You don't want to talk to them. They're just going to ask you for $3 checks to go on field trips.
We can do that.
Oh, no, payola. All right. Randy Stanley from Baltimore, thank you so much for coming in. I sure appreciate this.
Great to have you be here, Dara. Thank you.
All right. We're going to – oh, I got a question. What is the actual name of the restaurant? Baldemar, B-A-L, B like boy, B-A-L-D-E-R-M-A-R. So it's kind of like a ocean front, like old – timey thing? Is that like ocean era Baltimore? No?
Nope, not even close. But
what is it?
Good guess.
What is it?
So Sixsmith is an artisan. They were actually blacksmiths in early 10th century England.
And 10th century England to Wayzata. Good
yeah,
for
exactly.
them. To keep the brand going.
I liked it because it was a dead word and no one knows what they're in for. which is part of the concept. Same. So anyway, I was looking for some way to connect the two restaurants but not be the same. And Baldemar's early third century name of nobility.
Third century. They didn't even have the Bible all written
down. That's a good point.
Go on.
But anyway, it was a name of nobility, strength, honesty, integrity, hard work, and things like that. And in that particular century, there was a Baldemar who was the patron saint of blacksmiths.
Thank you, Texter. I would never have known about that. That is fascinating. All right.
How do we think of things like that?
you got a capacious brain, my friend. All right, Baldemar with a B up in Roseville. That was super fun. Now we're a little bit late for the news, but we can do this. Randy Stanley, thank you.
Dara, thanks.
Dara here. All right, so here's who I am. I just write about anything that comes by. I write about fish. I write about restaurants. I write about the people that are the movers and shakers of our community at Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine. Back in the day, I used to write for other publications, and that's where I first met Josh Nelson. Josh currently works at Almanac Fish, best fish market in St. Paul, I'd say, and Fish Guys, which I've written about. He is the human being that helps the co-ops and Kowalski's kind of get their fish scene together, and the fish scene at those places is excellent. And so Josh is here. We're going to talk about all things fish. I told you, surf and turf. Mm-hmm. We had the turf, and now we have the surf. Welcome, Josh.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Dara.
All right. So I can't actually remember the first time we spoke. I feel like it was a really long time ago, but maybe it was when you were leading up the Zoo's Fish Smart program, which was our first local version of, you know, what to eat sustainably to keep the health of the oceans going. And so you've been on the front lines of fish and sustainability for a long time. Where do you see things now? Just give me a general state of the oceans and / state of the plate.
That's okay. That's a great question. When I started out in anything seafood, I was a buyer over at Whole Foods, the old Grand Avenue Market. And, you know, part of their core values had things about sustainability. So I kind of got interested in that just as a, you know, almost a requirement of the job. As a lot of us line cooks do, we get old, we have kids, we get physically broken. So we venture into different areas of the...
That is a very tragic run up to a...
Well, you know, it is what it is. And
the knees are the weak part of the cooking industry.
The knees and the back. So I eventually went back to school, got a super useful degree in history, ended up at the Minnesota Zoo working with the Education Department and the Walton Family Foundation to create a program called Fish Smart, which worked with chefs in Minnesota to kind of raise the awareness of sustainability.
And you did.
And we did. And I had the opportunity to work with Mike Higgins on a couple projects, who is the owner of the Fish Guys. And he eventually poached me. And I went over to I went to the dark side. But I went to the dark side to try to create some change. And Mike's been a super awesome boss and business owner in the sense that that's what he wants to do too. I mean, it's in the fish guy's best interest to be sustainable, to responsibly source fish. So,
yes, that has been obvious. If you do not have any fish left in the ocean, we got problems all around.
So, you know, back then it was just getting to the point where sustainability, especially in a seafood sense, started seeing a little greenwashing. Barton Seaver was writing about how he hated the word and all kinds of things going on. And as I've come up through the Fish Guys and worked pretty much exclusively with retailers who want to go out and tell everyone how sustainable they are, the challenge has been, well, that's great. You can say what you want, but how are we going to measure this? So we started working with different organizations. Right now we're with the Fish Guys works very closely with the James Beard Foundation's Smart Catch program.
Yeah, I wrote about this last winter. We have such a huge participation rate in this James Beard or
largest in the country.
Largest in the country. And people think, "Oh, you're landlocked. You are not leaders in sustainable seafood." But no, the Twin Cities is a real leader in sustainable seafood, largely because of work of people like you. I wrote about the Fish Guys commitment to sustainable seafood, and a lot of people don't realize that you go to restaurants and, you know, they're not usually on the phone with a fisherman in Australia. They're working through someone right. like you. And if you won't give them dirty, stolen fish, then they can't get dirty, stolen fish.
Right, right. So, you know, we like to brag how we have relationships with all our vendors. I mean, we know guys in Alaska that fish for the sockeye in the Coho Forest. We know the farms that we get our farmed fish from. They've been vetted out. So, yeah, we're pretty confident in that sense. I mean, the chefs and the meat managers at the retail, they have to trust us that we're doing the right thing.
All right. And so the long way around, what do you see? What is the state of the plate? Is it better than it was 20 years ago? Is it worse? Is it just different?
I think, you know, in terms of aquaculture, we're really getting to the point where it's going to work.
Okay. You know, for the longest time. I was going to ask you about that. You want to just go straight to aquaculture? Because I have noticed that a couple of countries, Denmark, have put a moratorium on fish farms right now because there's just been problems, a lot of disease.
There's that, and it's kind of political, too. I mean, you got, you know, just like in the Pacific Northwest where they don't want salmon farms at all because, you know.
I think for good reason.
They don't want them
to escape. They don't want the disease into their wild fisheries. They don't want genetic pollution.
That's a little bit of overblown misinformation that they're going to compete for wild resources.
They are. I know. See, I will disagree.
I think they are going to a certain extent, but I don't think it's
until you have fish that can eat grain, you know, then you don't. Then you're going to be competing for wild resources,
right? So I think where aquaculture is now, it's like, you know, you got True Shrimp, the shrimp that we're supporting and being raised in Minnesota.
Yeah, you know,
this
is a system I've been meaning to get into forever. So tell me, what is going on? So this True Shrimp is really a commercial thing now? It's happening?
So I don't understand all of it. I know, like, when Schwann's got bought out by the mega conglomerate, whoever it was that bought them, a lot of those people took a lot of the money they made out of the sale and invested in this True Shrimp company. So there's a lot of money.
True Shrimp company is raising shrimp, you know, 1,000 miles from the ocean here in farm country.
Yep. And so closed RAS, they call it, closed recirculating aquaculture, is a system where the energy input outputs are equal. The water waste is all being cleaned before it goes. We're not dumping dirty water and
well, once you have fish waste and you're 1,000 miles from the ocean, it's then valuable. It's fertilizer.
Right. Right. So.
All right. So this closed system aquaculture, you feel like is at the tipping point?
Yeah.
It's
when Urban Organics was around, that's what they were doing with the char. And then they even had the aquaponics component where they were using that nutrient rich fish water to fish waste to grow plants.
Yeah, I wrote about that a few times. And but is that just gone away now, or is it?
Yeah, they had some technical problems that.
It's very hard to create an ecosystem inside. I mean, it was what will have to happen if we're going to colonize Mars, right. But it's not easy.
Well, you look at the Poland books, you know, it's secure regional food networks are what we need to survive and to make things sustainable. So, you know, fish has to come from around here.
Okay. So you feel like closed system aquaculture, that's fish growing indoors, closed system aquaculture, which won't pollute the oceans, that's finally commercially viable?
Getting there. Yeah.
Getting there a long time. All right.
Right.
So
it's closer than it ever was. I mean, yeah, it's
I was helping my kid do a science project recently, and we were looking at the people that discovered oxygen. And that's the kind of thing you just take it for granted. You know, it's oxygen. It's in the air. This is how we breathe. But it took a lot of people, probably 75 years, all working independently to get to that point. So sometimes human progress is slow and happens over many people requiring a lot of ingenuity, you know. And then in the rearview mirror, it looks like it just happened. It's
right.
natural.
I mean, just like with anything, once it becomes a commodity and investors and people get involved, things get muddied. So
aquaculture is good. I feel like since I've been doing this, and this could just be personal, awareness of the fragility of the oceans has risen.
And that's why I went directly into aquaculture, because the fragility of the oceans, and you even think about, you know, climate change and I mean, they're catching fish in southeastern Alaska that they normally saw in Oregon and Washington. I mean, you know, fish are migrating and moving, and it's going to create changes, and not all of them necessarily, you know, recoverable changes.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is state of the plate, state of sustainable fisheries is things are changing, but not possibly for the good, but it's not easily determined.
And what I mean by possibly for the good is if these fish are just migrating and you have to catch them somewhere else instead of where you're, you know, historically caught them, that's not the end of the world. But if the climate change and the water temperature chain is creating population declines and environmental degradation, then we got to, you know, then it's...
I can see you were a history major because we got a lot of possible factors influencing this. All right, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back with Josh Nelson of Almanac Fish and the Fish Guys. We're going to talk some more about the general state of sustainable fisheries, state of the ocean. You got any questions? Text us 651-989-9226. I have discovered that sometimes you have better ideas than I do. 651-989-9226. Dara in the house. I got all my personality. I'm bringing it to you 100%. Trying to make Jonathan laugh. He's ignoring me. It's not going to happen. Too bad for me. All right. So I got a question, really good question on the text line. What is your opinion, Josh Nelson of Almanac Fish, on the opinion on the quality of inspection of fish imported from, just say, Southeast Asia? That's so I've been talking about the fact that I do not like this fish farm fish from, say, Southeast Asia. I think it's full of heavy metals and weird veterinarian chemicals, and I won't eat it if I can avoid it. So I've completely tilted the playing field. What do you think about that stuff?
Man, I think it's a really iffy situation. I think your gut is right. I was still with the zoo, Mike from the Fish Guys and I were at a sustainability conference in Hong Kong, and Mike had the opportunity to go on field trips in China to see some of the more successful fish farms, and the best of their best, Mike was like horrified by.
Yeah, mangrove swamps are also endangered, and they are what prevents...
Yeah, and those mangroves don't grow back real quick.
They don't grow back, and they are what prevents the land from being washed away during monsoons. And we should... I don't think you're going to find anyone in this studio who... I mean, and the thing is, a lot of people don't know. You really should look for... I hate to just... say Kowalski's all the time, but Kowalski's did a great job of making all of their shrimp the good shrimp. And it's really, you know, you're not going to find the dirt cheap shrimp, but really the dirt cheap shrimp you shouldn't eat it, people, is not good for you. But Kowalski's has done, I forget the lingo. What do you call all the good shrimp now?
They run a line called Ultra.
Ultra.
And then they also do a wild Gulf USA white shrimp.
Oh, yeah. Gulf USA. Yeah, USA. That's really good stuff because our waters are the cleanest waters on earth and we should support our fishermen. Okay. So.
Well, and real quick, what I wanted to just finish off on in the Southeast Asia question to the texter was that shrimp is one of the things from Southeast Asia that I'm a little bit more comfortable with because it generally is farmed. And on the back of all of those retail bags is a little symbol in the bottom right corner that if you think in terms of Better Homes and Garden kind of seal of approval, it'll say ASC or BAP, Aquaculture Stewardship Council, or Best Aquaculture Practices. And it's a third-party scheme that allows a farm to come in and be audited and get rated on its sustainability. You know, in the ASC component, there's up to 5 stars. They can get a star for the farm. They can get a star for the feed. They can get a star for the brood program. And there's even a 5th star for human welfare, especially after all the Thai slave stuff and stuff. So
Thai slave stuff. Just live that out there. All right. There's a New York Times story a few years ago if you want to just
But
you know,
human welfare has become part of the definition
yes,
of sustainability,
as it should be.
And that's awesome.
As it absolutely should be. Okay, so your final word on the Southeast Asian shrimp is look for these sustainability stamps on it as a guarantee of quality. All right. We don't have a ton of time, but we were talking off air, and you were saying, you know, me asking you to give the big picture of sustainable seafood a little bit unfair because it's just 1,000 marketplaces, right? And
right.
so there are some that are doing great work and some that are doing bad work. And you wanted to kind of let's put a cap on our aquaculture, ocean aquaculture. You were saying there are places that do it right. Schooner Bay is an example. That's a brand.
Right.
It's a part of – it's a bay in Canada somewhere.
Schooner Bay is the farthest end of Vancouver Island where basically you're looking in, over to Japan.
And so it's not – you know, it's just like cram full of a bazillion fish. It's not
– No, they operate like 12 different – they have 20 sites. They operate 12, so they do what's akin to rotational grazing and keep certain farms fallow so ecosystems can you know, regenerate and such. But it's being farmed in these super deep fjord-like things that are the island out there, and it's fast moving tidal waters. It's nutrient rich. It's clean.
So Schooner Bay is an ocean aquaculture that you really like.
Yep.
And I should not just
it's a never
look at
ever
too many
thing.
Pictures
you know, never
online
any
about
antibiotics, the... never any growth hormones, things like that. And those are the kind of farms we're looking to do business with.
Okay, and so then we have to we trust you, and I appreciate you doing all this work because anybody's listening can say like, oh, that's really complicated.
Yeah.
You wanted to also talk about Fish Guys has been moving to try to make a more. What I like about what Fish Guys does is I don't have to think about it. I don't have to spend all my time on the Monterey Bay Seafood Watch website, which is fantastic, but has very little to do with what we actually get here in the Twin Cities.
Right.
And they're just sitting there going like, well, they say rockfish is good and you say rockfish is bad. And 30 people have different, you know, 1,000 communities call rockfish different things.
Right.
Because it just refers to a fish that lives in the rocks and nobody speaking to each other. But you guys do that work. So I can just be like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm going to relax and buy something at the co-ops or Kowalski's or, you know, or Almanac Fish, where you actually work. And, you know, and I cannot have these concerns pinging around my head, making me anxious. And you're trying to do the same thing for beef now.
We are. Fish Guys has Market House Meats. And we have built a full processing, USDA inspected processing plant down in Northfield. We're doing custom steaks and dry age. It's all non-commodity.
From good farmers, good local farmers.
Upper Iowa prime beef, Birkwood pork, Bell and Evans chicken, Ferndale Markets turkeys, you know, all the good stuff.
The more I am in this food game, the more I think it is unfair to put all of these responsibilities for the food supply chain on the end consumer. And so you guys are doing that for restaurants. You're making it
yeah.
so they can, well, somebody's got to. All right. You wanted me to try this amazing croissant.
So, yeah.
Down I did try. So down at Almanac, down is the fish market on the very north end of the St. Paul Farmers Market, the historic farmers market, oldest farmers market in the state. And you guys have a little fish market and a butcher counter up in the building.
Mm-hmm.
That's to the due north of the farmers market. And now Vikings and Goddesses, this bakery, has moved into the old Salty Tart space as well as Bakehouse.
Well, let me clarify
Lortown
that.
Bakehouse.
So Salty Tart closed its doors. Octo had been the owner of Salty Tart for quite a while. And now it's True North Coffee. Vikings and Goddesses are doing the pastries and desserts for True North and for Octo. And Lowertown Bakehouse is doing all the breads and rolls.
And you very kindly brought a soccer-themed croissant.
Yeah, Rebecca's
I'm going to get this onto my Instagram eventually here.
Beautiful.
And it's red and white, a red and croissant color striped. It's very fun. And it's because of a Manchester?
She said Liverpool versus Spurs.
All right.
So Rachel must be a big soccer fan.
Soccer croissant, my friends. Next week, Dan Oski from Tattersall. I have a big, big story on Akavit and the Minnesota Akavit boom in the current issue. We'll find out the story behind all that next week here on Off the Menu.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. ExpressPros.com.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now. And what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Fridman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colone for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.